Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Safety and Service Delivery Committee. We're going to have Ms. Keturah Harley on the phone to participate in this. She's a member of this committee. And I understand that Mrs. Hudgens is not available today, so I believe Christian Dorsey is going to represent Virginia for this particular meeting. Our first item of business is to approve today's agenda. Does anybody have any suggested changes? Hearing no objections, the agenda is approved as presented. Next is the approval of the minutes from our previous meeting. I'd like to ask for a motion from a committee member to approve the minutes of our December 14th session. Could I get a motion to approve this set of minutes? Do I hear a second?
Second.
All in favor? Aye. Okay, so the minutes are approved. Thank you. Now that we've addressed the committee's administrative business, I'd like to provide a brief overview of our agenda today. First, staff will present a program that is a demonstration of Metro's commitment to its customers and reflection of management's increased confidence in its ability to deliver reliable service. Customer Confidence Program is designed to retain and win back riders to the system. After we have our presentations, we'll be voting on that program to hopefully approve it and move it forward to the full board. Next, the committee will receive two informational updates, both concerning safety and security on board Metro Bus. First update will provide a comprehensive overview of the actions being taken to reduce customer and employee injuries on Metrobus by mitigating hazards using the safety management system. Finally, representatives of a peer review committee of the Public American Public Transportation Association, and this includes Polly Hansen of APTA and also Mr. Ken Rotter from New Jersey Transit. Welcome. We will go over and present the results of their review of Metrobus operator assaults. This review was undertaken as a way for Metro to learn from its peers as it works towards a system safer for its employees and the public. So with that, let's get started with the agenda, and I'm going to turn the floor over to Ms. Barasox, who's going to do the first presentation.
Actually, I think we have a safety contact this morning. Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. All right. Thank you, Mr.
So are you ready, Ms.?
I am.
Okay.
Yes,
thank you.
So one of the board's strategic priorities this year is to grow ridership, as you know, and this presentation continues the discussion we've been having with the committee about winning back riders who are concerned about service reliability. So I'm proud to say that we stand behind our service at Metro, and we want our customers to share that confidence with us. As part of our customer service improvements, we're introducing a reliability promise. It boils down to this. If you're delayed more than 15 minutes during the rush hour on either a train or a bus, your trip is on us. The Customer Confidence Program will demonstrate to new and returning customers our commitment to safe and reliable service. And for our management and our workforce, we want to be equally clear that we are accountable to our customers. And while things do happen beyond our control, we are committed to providing the best possible contingencies with our passengers in mind. But let me be absolutely clear. It has been true since the day the general manager first said it, that safety trumps service here at Metro. And we are reminding our managers and our employees that that will continue and that they should understand that their job is safety first and reliability second. We hope the new customer service approach will help us earn rider confidence. Today, about 90% of rail customers and about 80% of bus customers are arriving on time. And that is, as everybody knows, a market improvement from where we have been over the last couple of years. We've been reporting our progress to customers through our Back to Good communications efforts. And our customer research, conducted as recently as last month, has found strong favorable reaction to the Back to Good communications and the progress that we're making. In fact, if we could play a clip.
It really resonated with me. I thought it acknowledged some weaknesses and some long-standing issues that Metro has had. It attempted to address it and even tried to put some space between us seeing how they improve things and then what they're going to do next. So that seemed to be saying we still have some work to do, and then their goal that they set for themselves is we're going to get to good. And I thought that's just what they need to. I thought it was honest approach, and it was more humble.
And that customer was reflective of much of what we heard from customers, both in terms of regular commuters and less frequent customers, from all of the jurisdictions that ride all of the lines. But we know we still need to earn back their confidence. And while we've been improving tracks, trains, and schedules, and we have 6 months of good statistics that show we're getting better, we need to move beyond the numbers. We want to show our customers that we're accountable for delivering reliable service and that they'll get to their destination on time, especially when they're traveling to work. And by standing by our service, we mean to say that our rush hour service on weekdays will deliver you reliably and safely. For rail customers who have registered Smart Trip cards, they'll receive an email saying that they've been delayed 15 minutes or more during the weekday rush hour and their Smart Trip account is automatically being credited for the cost of their trip. For bus customers, since they don't tap in and tap out, we don't know when somebody's been delayed. So if there's a delay within Metro's control, such as a mechanical breakdown or a no-show bus customers will simply fill out a request form to get the credit. It's a simple and straightforward promise. Throughout 2018, we'll watch daily who has a My Trip Time experience that's more than 15 minutes late, and customers can track their own trip time on WMATA.com by looking up My Trip Time records on their Smart Trip card. It shows their travel history from tap-in to tap-out on rail. And importantly, the program is available on their Smart Trip accounts because it's a way for us to get that credit to them quickly and conveniently. We have about 6 million active Smart Trip cards in circulation, and about 1.3 million are actually registered. Registered cards account for about 65% of all of the trips taken during the rush hour. Again, this program would be good through 2018, through the calendar year, which time we would evaluate the value to the customer. The credit would be provided during this time, with only a very few exceptions. We would alert customers of extraordinary weather, such as a major winter storm, that kind of thing. That would suspend the credit for the day. We would also have the equivalent of a blackout date, if you will, for certain areas in the system if we advertise a capital project in advance that's going to reduce service or affect it in some ways. The recent capital improvement project on the Red Line, which was announced months in advance, is an example of what that might be. For customers, customers are accustomed to hearing that their train is delayed because we are responding to a medical emergency, there's been a sick customer, that would be included. We expect to still deliver you within the 15-minute window. A police activity, that would be eligible for the credit. Again, we still expect that we can manage that within our operating window. On the bus side, we can't take traffic delays into consideration. Obviously, that's something that's beyond our control. But if there's mechanical failure, again, that would be something that would be eligible for the credit. And finally, there will be a limit to prevent fraud on the program. We'll put a reasonable number of limitations on how many credits you could get in an individual month so that people can't take advantage of the program intentionally. But we don't think that's going to be a significant issue for us, again, because of the data that we're able to retrieve from our Smart Trip system. So what might this look like from a business perspective? This is what that chart shows. In the 4 months following completion of SafeTrack, more than 58 million trips were taken on Metro Rail. Of those, about 285,000 trips taken during the rush hour were delayed 15 minutes or more, and about 150,000 of those trips were taken by a customer using a registered Smart Trip card. So that gives you a sense of scale. Financially, under this program, full credit would be given to delayed riders who use stored value on their cards or Smart Benefits to pay for their trip. They would also be eligible. For past users who already received discounted fares, a credit for $3 on rail and a $1 bus credit would be provided. Excluded from this program would be UPass and the Kids Ride Free recipients. While we project an expense associated with this in terms of economic scale, about $2 to $3.5 million all in terms of credits and the communications program to get this information out to customers, we believe the offset in retained ridership and protected revenue may in fact pay for some or all of the program. With the board's approval, a customer confidence program would begin immediately on Friday, January 26th, after the board's formal vote on the matter, and remain in effect through the calendar year. Obviously, extensive communications campaign is required to get the message out to all of our riders and to those who might consider riding as a result of the program. Again, we'll reevaluate the program's effectiveness at the end of the year and return those findings to the board. Thank you, and I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bowersox, for your presentation. I've got a couple of questions. I just want to be clear. All situations will not be covered by this refund program?
No, not every situation. So if we were told that Snowmageddon was coming in February and the region were preparing for days for that, we might suspend the program for a day. That would be one example of when it would not be eligible.
What about scheduled maintenance, disruptions in service?
So if it's an emergency repair that we're making, that would be covered. If it's a capital project where we have a scheduled outage, that would not be covered because the customers would be given notice in advance.
Okay, and I think it's important to be very clear on what's covered and what's not so that we don't end up with expectations where our customers are expecting a refund and not able to get it because of the situation. So I think that's very important for this. I also wanted to ask about, you know, one of our main customers is the federal government and those workers that are on transit benefits. How would this program affect them? Because I believe they're provided those benefits directly by the government.
They are, but the credit would be eligible. They would be eligible for the credit under this program. And so, you know, for example, our largest SMART benefits customers work directly or indirectly with the Department of Defense. I'm very proud to serve both our military and civilian members in the region. And if they are delayed 15 minutes or more getting to work, the Pentagon, their account would be credited.
Thank you. I want to go to Ms. Harley, who I believe has joined us on the phone. Are you there, Ms. Harley?
Yes, Bob. Thank you so much.
Do you have any questions for us?
My main question is in regards to the bus side, and I brought this up, in that our bus ridership levels seem to have taken a little bit of a fall in recent months, and I'm just concerned that bus riders are participating in this program, but they have to take the extra step of getting off the bus, going home, filling out a form in order to get what the rail riders are getting continuously. And I'm just wondering if you could explain what the difference is between that is and why that extra step is going to be needed and what Metro can do to alleviate what I know will be some minor backlash to the fact that bus customers are being treated differently in this program than rail riders.
Sure. Thank you for the question, Ms. Harley. Unfortunately, because we don't have the tap out on bus, we don't know what your trip time is. And so that prevents us from knowing from our data whether or not an individual customer has been delayed some period of time. So what we're able to do is offer on their phones, because our WMATA.com site is fully functional on mobile devices, people will be able to go on their phones and submit the request for the credit. We will be able to process that very quickly and, again, credit their registered Smart Trip cards, just as we do for a rail rider. It is just that extra step, but, again, it is one that they can do without going home and waiting that time or getting to the office and waiting that time. They'll be able to do it on their phones.
And just as a follow-up to that question, the analysis of who is getting credited on the bus side versus the analysis of who's getting credited on the rail side, how is that set up? Is a person determining based on a physical review of the bus routes and what was happening in the form versus on the rail side? It seems like it's more automatic. Can you explain that process a little bit more?
Sure, that's the case. So more than a year ago, we established a measure, the first of its kind measure in the industry on the rail side called My Trip Time. It's made possible by the fact that we have smart trip technology that taps in and taps out. Essentially, what we've done is gotten very close to the customer experience, and we've measured the amount of time where a rail customer steps into a station, walks to the train, waits at the platform, boards the train, makes the transfer, gets to their destination, and taps out. We know what that time should take based on headways, based on walking time. We've approximated it based on a series of variables. We've tested that over time, and we know it to be a very, very strong measure. Because we have that data and because it's transparent to our customers, we can agree this is what your trip should take. And if it takes longer than that, we know because of your tap-in and tap-out times. We can pull every night an exception report that basically says, tell us everybody who took 15 minutes more than what it should have taken them to tap out. And we can give that credit based on that information. On the bus side, without the tap-out, we don't have that same data, and that's why the affirmative request from the customer is required. However, what we do have on the bus side is knowledge of where we have mechanical challenges with our buses or a no-show bus, and so we're able to very quickly then be able to say, yes, that is the circumstance that was on us, and we can give you the credit for that.
And in relation to Mr. Lauby's question, this is a program for all registered smart cards, regardless of what program they're originating from. Is that correct?
That's correct, and we haven't put a deadline on that. So if customers are hearing this message now or 2 months from now, they can go ahead and register their smart trip cards online to take advantage of the program. That's actually a great thing for us. It allows us better communication with our customer. It allows us to get you information about schedule changes and service options and feedback that we're looking for customers. We use that database to do research with our customers, to ask for their advice and their input on different matters that the board's considering. So there's a lot of really good reasons to get register your smart trip card. It's also a great opportunity to sign up for Metro Alert. So if your bus is delayed or your train is delayed, that information is getting pushed to your email or your phone. So that's a win-win for us if more people register and become eligible for the program.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all I have for right now. Thank you.
All right, I want to go over to Mr. Marucci, and then we'll go to Mr. Dorsey, and then we'll open it up for the rest of the board members.
Thanks. Can you, first of all, I commend this this innovation. I think it's a good approach. Can you talk a little bit about the marketing strategy? Is there an adequate budget for a marketing campaign? And how will customers get a communication that they are receiving a credit?
Sure. So we do have a budget for this year that I believe is adequate for the challenge. We're going to use all of our existing channels. In other words, use posters on the system, station announcements. The WMATA.com website is our most powerful gateway in informing customers. We're then going to reach out through print to other language communities. We do 7 languages in a standard way to make sure that we're reaching all of our customers. We have radio ads and television as well, and we'll use what is the most cost-effective channel these days, which is social media, very, very aggressively to get the word out. I feel confident that we will reach at least 90% of our current and potential customer base in the region, given the media plan that we have, and we'll be able to track that, and we have metrics that we'll associate with that to track awareness, and then we'll be able to go back and see if we, in fact, achieve that level of awareness.
And how will, you may have already said this, will customers receive a communication that they have received a credit, both on the bus and rail side?
Yes, so in about one business day, again, we run these reports overnight. So in about one business day, you should get an email that says, we know you've been delayed, we apologize, and your account will be credited. That takes a few days for that credit to move forward, but you should get that email very quickly.
Thank you, Chair Lobby. So a few questions. First, since this does have a fiscal impact on the 18 budget, and I appreciate Ms. Bowersox that you think that this could be offset by increased ridership, comment and then a question. I do think that probably the fiscal impact should have been evaluated in the Finance Committee, given that there should have been at least some board-level discussion of what those costs and offsetting revenue impacts are, because as it stands, this committee is being asked to forward a recommendation that could have a fiscal impact, you stated, of $2 to $3.5 million, and we have unknown offsets, and I just think from a governance perspective, we probably should have stress-tested that a bit. So if you could just share why you chose not to discuss at least that component in the Finance Committee.
Sure. I'll address that one if I may. For the 18 budget, as you know, we started that almost 18 months ago, and a lot of this has obviously evolved. But one thing we did discuss, and I heard very clearly from the board, was that we can't cut our way out of a lot of these issues. We have to think of the riders. We have to think of the revenue side of it. So we continue to do that, and we will continue to do that. And so we've done a lot of research. We actually had just gotten, and we're using more analytics in some of our thinking. So some of that data is new, and we started to sort of get a sense. I can't remember if we reported to a committee or not, but one of the things we found is that if someone experiences a 30-minute delay, they generally will not try us again for 3 months or so. So we started to think through that, and, you know, what's the, and then we set up the focus groups to sort of, you know, test this. We also, as you remember, in the 18 budget and in the 19 budget, you know, we saw a drop in revenues due to loss of fares of roughly about $24 million. So, in effect, where the dollars would come from, hopefully, is from that. If not, I'll have to eat it, in effect, within the existing budget in some way. But I believe as we get this out there, I think it does reflect that the system actually does run fairly well every day for people, particularly in the rush hour. And we want to promote that and make sure that that if they do experience something, that we recognize it and we get right back to them immediately and say we recognize it and here's what we're doing about it. And I think that will help hopefully reduce that $24 million hit that we are anticipating. You know, again, that's a projection, and we're trying to minimize it as much as possible.
I appreciate that. I think my comment, I would say, still stands, that we should have figured out some way to at least have had that conversation at the Finance Committee meeting in conjunction with or as part of it. A few questions about the operations of the program. And generally, I think this is a terrific, as Mr. Marudian said, a terrific innovation. It's a great thing to do to deliver to our customers, but it's not without risk. And I want to just ask about a couple of items. And Ms. Harley, you know, I think rightly brought up the bus side and the equity of how we're delivering there. A question about how to... Would there be a way on the bus side to, if there is a malfunction, to use the tap-in component and the operator's discretion for them to actually just not require somebody to tap in if there is a delay that's 15 minutes based on a malfunction or a late dispatch? So in other words, you don't have to go through the process of submitting a form. The operator can either decide to wave people through or can zero out the Smart Trip reader if we require a tap, so that it doesn't actually charge someone if, in fact, it's very clear what the bus delay is. Is that something that's possible?
I think we can look at that as we evaluate over the next couple of weeks what the terms and conditions are. I do not think that technically we can do two things, which is have the bus operators waive tapping in for only some people on certain routes versus what we program at the garage. So I have to look at that and see what the capability is, but we will.
Okay. That's great. I just think, you know, the equity thing is important, and, you know, if we can do something to bridge that gap, that would be great. Next question concerns just limiting this to rush hour. A great deal of our rider erosion is during the off-peak, and, you know, arguably, if you're delayed during the off-peak, you may be extra aggravated and extra motivated to leave the system if you encounter such a delay, since the frequency of service is not as great. Is it a fiscal reason that we didn't extend this to other hours? What's the rationale behind that?
We think this is a great place to start, and it may be that once we evaluate it, that it's something that we expand. But we just don't know that yet, and so we really wanted to focus on where we thought we had the strongest service at this point, both in terms of frequency and in terms of on-time performance. Also being aware of the fact that some of our maintenance is done in the late evening hours, certainly on the weekends, and so the number of exceptions made there for planned maintenance would be more than we have in the rush hour, recognizing some of those things. So we wanted to start now, and as we look at the capital program going forward and better understand nights and weekends and other off-peak times, we could make an assessment then.
I would encourage us not to lose sight of that as this moves forward. And then the last question, Chair Lobby, even though I really applaud your thinking, I think good planning and technology is helping to avoid some of the fraud issues that other jurisdictions have had when they tried to implement this. There still seems to me to be the possibility that someone can game the system. And, you know, the most obvious is the rider who, even though they're traveling during the rush hour, is not necessarily time stressed and can decide hanging out at a station for 15 minutes can get me a free ride. Have we thought about that?
Yes, and so I think that's why we would cap the number of eligible credits in a month's time. So, you know, whether it's going to be 4 or 5 or 6 hasn't been determined, but I think to prevent exactly what you just described, there needs to be an upper limit.
Thank you.
I want to go to Mr. Golden, and I'm going to come over to Mr. Golden.
Oh, thank you. I would just echo what Mr. Dorsey says. I think this is a very good idea. As we'll be talking about in the Finance Committee, we have a deficit now on the ridership revenue side of $20 million looking into FY19 from what was budgeted in FY18. So any initiative that can close that gap, I think, is something worthy to be tried. You know, having said that, I think I need to better understand how this actually works. So I want to just take you through a hypothetical and see if I understand what happens. So if I'm a red line commuter rush hour getting on at Shady Grove where the headways are 8 minutes. So if I tap in, and I assume this is based on tap in, tap out times. So if I tap in, but I'm sort of slow getting down to the platform, and I miss the train. I see that train, but I miss it. And so I'm now waiting another 8 minutes for the next train. That, obviously, 8 minutes alone is not going to trigger the 15-minute time period. But if in addition to those 8 minutes, if I end up on a red line train that unfortunately has to go through some single tracking, and I'm delayed another 8 minutes on my trip from Shady Grove to Metro Center, so a total of 16 minutes, am I now a customer who's eligible for the credit?
Not necessarily, because as I understand your hypothetical, the first 8 minutes that you described is already baked into the My Trip Time assessment, because from the time you tapped in, the train wasn't immediately available to you, so that's already in that time. But the additional time that you were delayed would have been counted, but it didn't exceed the 15-minute barrier. So if I may, I'll give you, and thank you for picking my home station, Mr. Goldman. You always try to make it easier for me, and I appreciate that.
I tried to do things in a Montgomery County context. <yes. laughs>
Let me give you an example from this week, a red line example that will help, I think. So on Monday, we had a customer, and I don't know the customer's name. I just know their Smart Trip ID number, who took a trip from between DuPont Circle and Bethesda on the red line, okay? And it was in the rush hour, and the customer tapped into DuPont at 7:22 in the morning and tapped out of Bethesda at 7:59 and paid $3.20, okay? But that total trip duration from tap in to tap out was 36 minutes, and by the My Trip Time score, it should have taken 21. Therefore, they would have gotten their $3.20 credit. The reason for the delay, by the way, was that 2 minutes before the customer entered the system, we had a train that was taken out of service for a door issue at Judiciary Square, and there was a backup created, a domino effect in the direction of Shady Grove. So that red line customer would have benefited from it. Does that help?
Yeah. What you're saying is that essentially to get the 15 minutes, it has to be something that results in the operation of the trains and not just the fact that you've ended up because you've been slow to get to the platform that you lost 8 minutes. That isn't part of your eligible time.
And it may also be helpful to remind our customers that the general manager instituted a 15-minute grace period that's still in effect. And so if you come to the system and you tap in, but you find that there's a major service disruption and you tap out again at the same station in less than 15 minutes, you're getting your money back then too. So this is not instead of that, it's in addition to that.
I just wanted to follow up on one more point from Mr. Dorsey, where we talked about the cost. There's obviously a budgetary impact for this, and I guess it appears to be from your numbers sometime north of $2 million annually on a 12-month basis. It seemed to be about $1.8 to $1.9 million just for Metro Rail, so I assume that the Metro bus would get you up there. Have you calculated how many new riders would be needed to make the system whole for the anticipated credits that will be provided over a 12-month period? How many new riders do we have to attract to the system to make this a positive experience for the authority?
So it's not just new riders, it's also more trips. So as Paul mentioned, 30% of the customers start traveling less as a result of reliability. And when you dig into that number and you talk to those customers, you learn that if they've had a major delay, 30 minutes or more, that they start taking fewer trips. Some of them don't come back for a few months, and when they do, they take even fewer. So what we're trying to protect is two things. We're trying to win back riders who may have left the system, but we're also trying to recover riders who have one bad experience by saying, we're not going to charge you for that. Please keep riding with us. We will do better next time.
Sure. But whether it's new riders or more trips by existing riders, there's still a number of trips that have to be experienced over what we're actually experiencing now.
Sure, we'll get
for
you
the
that
system.
Number.
If you can present that at a finance committee meeting, because I suspect next month we'll probably have a review on where we are in FY18, and perhaps that would be a good time to be able to mark this and see where what we need to break even on this kind of a program. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned with fraud and abuse. Okay. What's the metrics that we need to know about at the board that the Oyster in London experienced and other U.S. domestic transit agencies? And correlated to that is what kind of additional staffing are we going to have to deal with to avoid people gaming the system?
I think that the lessons learned from other properties, you mentioned London, Boston is another one, is that they weren't able to offer their credit automatically. They didn't have the same data that we have. And in fact, Toronto is looking to automate theirs now. They have a 15-minute credit. It's been in place for 3 years, and they were trying to go to the automation for convenience reasons as well as fraud prevention reasons. Ours allows us to be able to see the path of travel of the customer. So apart from the situation that Mr. Dorsey described, which is where somebody stays on the system and tries not to leave for some amount of time, virtually the data protects you from the false claims that might come in. On the bus side, where you do have a claim coming in, again, we get to check that against our records about where buses have broken down or have not been dispatched, and that's the protection there. We do believe that we can manage this based on the travel that we see with the customer service staff that we have today, and that's our plan.
Any other questions from any committee members or board members? I've got one other thing that I want to bring up before we vote on this, and Washington Metro is trying to build a robust safety culture here. And we have Mr. Leader, Chief Operations Officer. We have our General Manager, Mr. Wiedefel, and we have Pat Lavin, our Chief Safety Officer. I want to make sure that as we move forward, that this kind of program doesn't become an incentive to make a unsafe decision on whether to take a train out of service, whether to single track, other things. And I just like to hear if you've considered that particular risk and if you're committed to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it never will. I mean, that's where Ms. Bowersock started, is that it will always be safety first, and that is the way we operate. We will continue to do that. We've done it. We've been doing it for a good almost 2 years now, and we will continue that in the future. And we, in fact, when we rolled this out, when we put this out public or internally, that was the first thing we said to our employees. It's like, this has nothing to do with safety. It's still safety trumps service all the time. This is just something that when it works, in a normal course of business, fine, but we're not going to make any decision based on this that would impact safety.
Perfect. Thank you. We've heard staff's presentation on this item and their proposal for the 2018 Customer Confidence Program. Can I get a motion from a member of the committee for approval?
I'll make the motion.
So moved.
Can I have a second? Second? Okay, we have 2 seconds, so that's good. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. The motion passes. Thank you very much, Ms. Bowersox, for your presentation. All right, we have two other important items on the agenda that we want to move to. The first is the bus safety initiatives. Mr. Lavin's going to cover that, I believe. Mr. Lavin.
So it'll be a joint effort between myself and Mr. Leader, so I'll tee it off to him about midway. So just let me know whenever you're ready, Leander. Let's go to the next slide. You go to the next slide. Thank you. Okay, safety management systems provide a systematic way to control risk and to provide assurance that risk controls are effective. Through the safety risk management process, hazards are identified to control risk. To illustrate this process, I will discuss the recent NABI bus incidents and how this event was managed under the principles of SMS. So just for situational awareness, we've had 2 incidents in which NABI buses stalled over a 3-day period. In both of those incidents, the operator, once the bus stalled, they lost control of the bus, and it affected the power steering features of the bus. So at that time, after the second incident, I met with Mr. Leader. Our recommendation was to go to the GM and request that we ground all 105 buses, which happened that same day. So the investigation identified three actual failures of different natures that affected the buses. In the first incident, a bus operator was operating on 395 in an HOV lane when the bus stalled. Upon review of the video, you could see that the lights came on the dashboard alerting or providing an alert that the bus stall was imminent. However, there was no audible alarm to the bus. Therefore, the operator didn't receive sufficient indication that this bus was going to stall out and he was going to lose control. So when we did the investigation, what we found is that when we had received the NABI buses from the factory, that this feature, the software feature, this alert, was not contained in any of the 105 buses. We partnered with New Flyer. They came in and they corrected that condition by installing the software. That item is also now part of the safety certification list, so any new buses coming in, we won't make that same mistake again. In the second bus, what had happened, there was a master controller upgrade that was occurring, and in that button, we found that the mechanic, it was the first time they had performed that activity, they had written instructions, but they were never supervised on how to do it. That individual miswired that master controller button. It set off a timer, and eventually it called the bus to stall. And once again, due to the audible alarm feature not being present, that operator lost control of the bus. We since inspected all 105 buses, and the master controllers were verified to be wired correctly. As a secondary part of the investigation, we also identified that we had had a bus pull to the left. When we looked at it, one of the brake pads were cracked. We did further investigation. There's a module called an e-stroke harness that tells you which tires are experiencing a problem. We found that that was also miswired. So what we did is we brought New Flyer in. They inspected 105 buses. Approximately 80 of them were miswired. We've corrected that. And from partnering with New Flyer, they sent a service bulletin out to the industry. So any other customer who has this model bus will be aware of this so they can address it as well. And presently, I believe 50 of the New Flyer buses are back in service. And once we complete the PMIs on the other, the whole fleet will be returned to service. If there's any questions on this incident, if not, I'm going to move on to Joe Leader. These are the following initiatives that Joe is going to talk about. Also support the safety risk management component of the SMS structure. So Joe?
All right. Thank you, Pat. Next, I'd like to share some improvements we are making on our bus technology and equipment to keep our customers and our pedestrians safe. And then this will be followed by the actions currently underway to reduce assaults against our bus operators. The first few safety initiatives are aimed at preventing rear-end and pedestrian incidents. Pedestrian strobe lights are being installed on all our buses. This was historically prohibited in Virginia due to a vehicular code restriction. However, Metro was able to demonstrate a strong correlation between strobe buses and a decrease in pedestrian-type accidents. And through this effort, we were able to get the Virginia legislation to change, and now we can put these strobe lights on all our buses in Maryland, D.C., and in Virginia. Phase one, we outfitted 100 buses. That was back in 2010 where we began the pilot, and again, that was only in Maryland and D.C., and we immediately started to see a decrease in those types of accidents. Phase two is currently underway. At this time, we have 756 buses that currently have these strobe lights. That's roughly about 50% of the fleet. To date, we have seen about a 30% reduction in pedestrian and cyclist strikes since we began installing these strobe lights. What I'd like to do is go to the next slide, which is a little video of the strobe lights working. Okay. Next, deceleration lights are being installed on the back of the buses as a method to reduce rear-end collisions. And I think at a prior meeting we spoke about the increase in customer accidents and employee accidents or injuries was the result of mostly collisions, and we saw a significant rise on the bus side. The lights will alert vehicles behind the bus that the bus is slowing down or coming to a stop. The initiative started with a pilot of 10 buses back in the calendar year 2016, and we began to see a marked decrease in rear-end collisions for those buses that were equipped. To date, 657 deacceleration lights have been installed on buses. That's about 43% of the fleet. These rear-mounted lights operate in three circumstances, each designed to communicate a specific hazard. The first hazard is when a bus is decelerating. The second hazard is when a bus is coming to a service stop. So when the bus comes to a complete stop and one of the doors, the front or the rear doors are open, that light will flash indicating the bus is stopped. And also when a bus is backing up. This is a particular hazardous period in a bus operations. It doesn't happen all the time, but can. And when the bus is shifted into reverse, the light will begin flashing continuously, and then the destination sign will change and say, caution, bus is backing. We'd like to move to the next slide, which shows a small video. Okay, continuing with our initiatives, the mirror lowering and adjustment campaign was the result of an employee concern raised through our close call system, our program. As you know, the program provides Ramada employees with a confidential platform, so close call events can be reported voluntarily without fear of any disciplinary action. In the past, mirror-related incidents have contributed to bus strike collisions. Staff addressed this by retrofitting the high-mounted mirrors on 351 low-floor advanced buses. 202 buses are complete at this time. That's 58% of our buses, and we expect to complete the rest of the mirrors by June of 2018. Next, we began modifying the mirror position by identifying the proper parallel alignment of the mirror arm. And since we've done that, we've seen a 19% decrease in strike collision as compared to calendar year 2016. Bus operators still have the opportunity to adjust the mirror, but what we've done is lock the arm in a set position so it doesn't extend too far out and strike something as the bus is moving into a bus stop. I'd like to move on now to the actions that we're currently underway to improve bus safety and security and reduce assaults against our employees. The chart on the right side shows the recent calendar year through early December 2017 statistics for assaults against Metro bus operators. They are up 20 incidents at 90 compared to 70 this time last year. Causes are generally due to verbal altercations, often originating from a fare dispute. Some of the strategies that we have in place to address this is from our MetroStat meetings, deploying targeted resources from the police department on lines that are experiencing a high rate of assaults, deploying high-intensity targeted enforcements. These are small teams that we will you know, periodically put out during either the AM or the PM when we have most of our customers on our buses. The police officers will engage the customers as well, engage the bus operator when the bus comes to a stop, and to make sure that everything is safe on the bus. We also continue to discuss at our bus division safety meetings all the assaults that are happening, and we try and get the message out to our employees what's occurring on the line. We are also applying some overtime to reduce fare evasion. We will continue with our Respect Your Ride youth campaign, where our officers will go into schools and speak to young adults and try and explain to them the proper way of using our system and stay out of trouble. And then finally, working with our prosecutors when an assault happens to try and get the maximum penalty that we possibly can. Next, other initiatives include providing bus operators de-escalation tactics and conflict resolution training during new bus operating training or refresher training. This class is offered right now at Blaytonsburg and Shepherd's Parkway. Those are the two divisions that are experienced the highest assaults. A total of 167 participants have completed the class as of November of 2017. The class focuses on conflict resolution objectives, and what we try and do is reinforce de-escalation techniques, and this class currently is being taught by the police department to our bus operators. We also inform our operators of their rights, of what they can do to defend themselves. We also provide the operators with an opportunity to be heard and share their experiences. And I think one of the most important parts of this training is role-playing. So the police officer will become the irate customer towards the operator and allow the operator that, you know, experience of trying to figure out how to de-escalate the incident with the customer. Again, automatic fare announcements are also active on all our buses, and we hope that this will eliminate that potential contact, verbal contact between our bus operators and the customer regarding fare evasion. The utilization of bus yields continues, and also we began to reiterate to our bus operators how to properly utilize the silent alarm in the event of emergency. We're going to talk about that on the next slide. But regarding the shield installations, 533 have been installed to date. That's 34% of our fleet. The third quarter of this year, we will have 100 new buses coming online, and they will have bus shields. We are also overhauling 100 buses, which is part of our midlife overhaul. They will be getting bus shields, and we will continue to install more and more buses with shields. And we believe by June of 2019, we will complete all buses, all 1,500 buses in our fleet will have bus shields. In case of a threatening and disruptive behavior aboard a bus, an operator can activate a silent alarm that goes back to the bus control center and directly to the police. This disruptive passenger has no way of knowing the alarm has been activated or that police are on their way. When the alarm is activated, the destination sign on the outside of the bus automatically changes and says, call police. And the outside running lights flash to let a police officer or any police units responding to know which bus, in case there's multiple buses in the area, which one is the one that is requiring assistance. What happens when you push the button, it sends out again a silent radio call to the bus control center. It opens a covert microphone so the bus command center can hear what's going on inside the bus at that time. It also activates the drive cam and the CCTV so we can get a copy of what's happening. And again, the sign on the outside of the bus will say, call police. And finally, a campaign that just started in November of 2017, and I would like to thank Lynn Barrosock's group, Media Relations. What we're trying to do is begin a campaign, and the purpose of it is to humanize our bus drivers in the eyes of our passengers. You know, when a customer comes on our bus, they see our bus operator. They see that uniform, and they think it's Metro. But behind that uniform is actually just a human being. It's a mother. It's a father. It's a community leader. It's a coach in your local sports club. And that's what we're trying to get the message out. It was launched, this campaign, in November of 2017, and it's in both print, digital, as well as radio, and we have a small audio.
I'm a daughter, an aunt, a proud football mom, a volunteer, an avid reader, and an active member of my community right here in D.C. But you know me as your local Metro bus driver. You depend on me to get where you're going, and I'm serious about my responsibility to get you there safely. I hope you'll see me for all the things I am and respect me like I respect you. After all, we take this trip together.
Okay, and with that, I'll take any questions if there are.
Thank you, Mr. Leader. Thank you, Mr. Lavin, for your reports. I noticed that everything is going to be installed on a lot of the different features by June 2019. What's the significance of that date?
It's just where we feel we can bring all the programs together. We would love to be able to work on all the buses all at once, but we have service to provide, so we have to, you know, sporadically take buses out and program it. So based on where programs, you know, and also depending on the activity or initiatives, for instance, a bus shield could take up to 5 days to install compared to a strobe light that could be much quicker. So speaking with my engineering department and bus, as well as the on the maintenance side, we feel we can bring all the programs together by June of 2019.
And I assume with all the different features that we've talked about today, the changes at the mirrors and other things that our labor unions have been partners in these discussions?
Yes, actually, we have an ergonomics group in bus that we have our engineering team, our maintenance team, as well as representatives of 689 as well as 922. On that committee. They discuss issues, whether they're maintenance issues or different things that are affecting the bus operations, and they work together to kind of come up with fixes.
One observation, I'm very impressed with the security items that are on these buses now. It seems to me like if I'm a criminal or something, this is about the worst place in the world to start a fight or commit a crime, because we automatically call the police, we put it on camera, we have audio, video, everything. So hopefully we're going to see some improvements and reductions in crimes on buses, especially since we seem to have had quite a few in the last few months.
Definitely. I think the cameras are definitely one tactic that our police department is using very well to solve crime. But hopefully the word will get out that people will realize they are being viewed so that no crime will come to our system.
Very good. I want to go to Ms. Hurley on the phone. Do you have any questions, Ms. Hurley?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Robbie. My question is more of from a process perspective. Can you talk a little bit on retrofitting the buses? I know that you said some of the running light issues, the pedestrian lights, were not allowed in Virginia until Metro carved out a legislative purpose for doing so. But can you explain a little bit as to why we are not preemptively putting some of these items on and why we're having to retrofit after we have gotten these buses already, and what our process is now going forward in acquiring new buses if we're implementing the changes that we're retrofitting to those buses before they come off the line?
Well, we've changed the specifications for the new buses coming on board, so as new buses come on board, they will have all these items on, already installed. Our program right now is to receive about 100 new buses each year, so instead of waiting for all new arrivals, we're going back to retrofit the fleet, starting with the buses that will be around the longest, and then, as you know, because we are retiring 100 buses a year.
So in regard to the process of retrofitting, how are those suggestions being up to the level of, okay, yes, this is a good concern, we're going to spend Metro's money and resources retrofitting these buses to do this? Is this a panel of people made up of management, employees, customers, incidents that happen, and then Metro goes back and says, oh, we should have put the mirror, here, or
it would be better if we had these lights on the front and this message. Can you explain how that process comes together to the point where we're retrofitting an entire fleet of buses to have these changes?
So I think it's a combination of a lot of different streams. As Joe pointed out in the presentation, for example, the lowering of the bus mirror that came through the close call reporting system. Other issues have come to the ergonomics committee. When we discussed the shield, the union was a part of that, and we landed on a shield that was acceptable to both management and the union. So I don't think it's just one defined way. There's multiple streams of how we collect this information and the approaches we take to address it. Other is industry best practices that are done at other properties, you know, things that are brought to our attention through groups such as APTA. So there's a wide variety of methods of collecting this information and acting on it.
What is the priority? Is there a system of priority layers that we have? For instance, most in the news lately is the incidents between customers and bus drivers with the bus shields. I mean, is there a priority checklist of when you take a bus out of service to retrofit it, this is what we want to install first, and then these other things come later, or are when we get a bus off, whatever is next in line is kind of done. Can you explain how that process works?
Well, we're trying to outfit, you know, routes or lines that have high assaults, but I mean, we could have an assault on almost any route, so there's really no distinct priority. The idea, really the priority, is to get all our shields installed by June of 2019. That is really our priority, to get it done. You know, some, I mean, there are agencies out there that don't even have bus shields on there, okay? And there's other agencies that are just targeting certain areas. We want to get every bus out there with a shield, and that's really our priority, is just to work towards that right now.
So when a bus comes off of line for retrofitting, how long is it out? Is everything being done at one time, or is it cycling through a process?
The initiatives take different amounts of times. Like I mentioned before, the bus shield takes roughly about 5 days to install. And again, being that these initiatives started at different times, okay, they didn't all start all at once. They started at different times as we solve problems. So we're buses are in different stages. Some have them all, some have, you know, two or three of the initiatives installed. But again, we believe the way it's all coming together, being planned out right now, by June of 2019, all our buses will be outfitted with these initiatives.
Okay. Thank you so much for your presentation. I look forward to an update. That's all I have for now.
Thank you, Ms. Harley. Let's go on to Mr. Marucci.
Sure. Regarding the conflict de-escalation training, is there a time frame in which you hope to have all operators trained?
We don't have that date yet. Okay. You know, because again, we're you know, it's a scheduling issue. I mean, we have to make sure we have enough operators for service and stuff, so we're trying to schedule it through. But what we're going to do is target the areas that are having the highest level of bus operator assaults, and those are those two divisions. We want to get through them first, and then we'll move on to the other divisions.
Got it. So, and my second question along those lines, which you might not have a date for, is is there a requirement for a refresher training? Is that something that you're thinking about?
Right. This is going to be incorporated now into our refresher training. So as bus operators go through, we'll have basically two fronts going. I'm going to continue with Metro Police. Metro Police is going to be now training my regular bus operator instructors. So we'll have two fronts going. And then eventually it will always be part of the refresher training for a bus operator when they go through.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. So what – refresh my memory. I seem to recall at some point we discussed the percentage of operator – employee assaults that were due to fare disputes. Can you recall offhand what that rough percentage is?
No, I don't think one. Is it? I don't think we broke it down to, okay, yes. Okay, verbal disputes of the 27% were of some form of a verbal altercation. 23% were from a fare dispute.
Okay. So this is all terrific, and I'm just want to focus on the fare disputes. It seems to me that the best way to at least try to deal with a significant chunk is to eliminate fare disputes, and that's when you think about innovations like off-vehicle fare collection, for example, as a way to kind of reduce some conflict. So are we marrying these safety initiatives with some of these other initiatives that have long been talked about but that we haven't necessarily moved forward with due to other priority needs?
We're not looking right now, or at least not since I've been here, of the off-board, because that brings in a different, you know, you would have to really police that if you're going to, you know, and that brings in, and it's a different business practice if you want to do it. New York has done some of that in select bus service.
Right.
Okay. But then again, they had to ramp up a large amount of what they call ticket agents that can go and police that, if you want to call it. I think what we're trying to do is to, we've gone to the automated announcements. We've gone to training and reminding the bus operators now that being that there's an automated announcement, they don't have to remind a customer to pay their fare. We have what is known as an F8 key that they can press. We just want them to document, okay, that there was a fare evasion that just took place so that we have a record of, you know, where we're seeing the higher rate, and that's some of the data we use to deploy our police department so we can target certain areas. That's where we want to go right now.
Okay.
Any other questions from board members? Mr. Bolger.
So I said we have some guests with us. I wanted to ask our guests, these shields, which I think are overkill, that we don't need 100% of our buses with the shields, but the shields that we're on, that are on the places that we need them, are they the right kind of shields? What do you guys think?
We're going to get to that.
Oh, okay. I can't ask now. I have to wait. Okay. But I disagree that when I talk to our bus drivers in Upper Northwest, okay, where I live, they don't need the shields.
I agree with you, and the new shield that we've gone to has a retractable window. Okay. So that is the new prototype. It's the one that we worked with the union on, and that's where we're going to be going to. So every new bus is going to come in with that. You're right in the sense that there are a lot of safe lines, and I think our customers like to interact with our bus operators. Good morning, how are you? You know, how's your day going? The issue, though, comes, you can't always guarantee that's the customer that's coming on that bus. And where those buses go, you know, depending on the divisions, they go on different routes. So the idea is to equip it, to train our bus operators to have it at least closed, with the new style, have it closed. They have the option to slide that glass back. And then if they feel there's that's where we're going. That's why we chose that new shield.
Any other questions from board members? Yes, sir, Mr. Cox.
Joe, I can't, there was a slide in there that I didn't have in my deck, so maybe I missed something, but you mentioned overtime. Being implemented as part of the making some of these safety improvements. What could you go a little bit further on that?
It's not on the improvements. It was towards the fare evasion. So it's what I've done in my own budget is allocated some overtime to MTPD so that they can go out and do enforcement on so I can have additional officers out there to try and stop some of the fare evasion on some of the routes.
So additional officers on the buses and at the stops?
Correct.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. I know we're a bit over time today, but this is a very important discussion, and I want to quickly move on to our next subject, and this is the APTA peer review, and we have some important guests here. We have Polly Hansen from the American Public Transportation Association and Ken Rotter, from New Jersey Transit, who are going to give us a sneak peek at some of the things the peer review team has found looking at preventing and mitigating passenger assaults.
Yes, sir, and good morning. As mentioned, my name is Polly Hansen. I'm the Director of Security, Risk, and Emergency Management with the American Public Transportation Association, otherwise known as APTA. And once again, joining me today is Ken Rotter, who's the Deputy General Manager of Bus Administration and Labor Relations from New Jersey Transit. This is a list of the transit source matter experts that served on the peer review panel. And as you can see, in addition to Mr. Rotter, also serving on the panel was a chief of police and an assistant director of bus operations. In September of 2017, the general manager contacted APTA and requested a peer review to look at best industry practices for preventing and mitigating passenger assaults of Metro Transit employees, in particular bus operators and station managers. The peer review was performed at WMATA in November over the course of the week of November 13th. The APTA peer review service is a highly successful and credible tool employed to assist with the development of strategies and solutions to transit issues. Dedicated transit source matter experts volunteer their time to examine an issue, provide findings and observations, and make recommendations to senior management of the transit agency. This is a list of the areas we examine, and it helped guide who we interviewed and what we examined. We also reviewed WMATA documents, looked at training and programs, and looked at industry reports, studies, and recommended best practices, as well as conducted numerous interviews of Metro managers and labor. Ken Rotter will now present the findings, observations, industry best practices, and the recommendations that were shared with WMATA.
Good morning, everyone. So we were here for a full week and conducted days and days of interviews, reviewed all the relevant documentation. So this report is a product of all of that work, and I'm here on behalf of the entire peer review committee, which Polly described to you before. So Joe Leader stole a bit of my thunder because I think his presentation really in detail went through many of our findings. So I'm gonna go through them quickly, but I want to drill down a little bit deeper into them beyond what's outlined on slide 7. So you see on slide 7, you know, WMATA has already installed shields in more than a third of its fleet. They have video surveillance, drive cam, CCTV monitors, automatic vehicle location systems. You have an enunciated message which quotes the fare, which is very important because, as you saw, fare disputes are probably the leading cause of operator assaults. I would venture to guess that those are captured within some of their verbal altercations. The silent emergency alarm system and the call police message on the destination sign, all of these are best practices in the industry. You have a robust program, training program designed to instruct on de-escalation. WMATA also has developed a public information campaign, which was described to you, as well as the Respect Your Ride initiative. So there's other findings on the next slide, on and on. EAP, a lot of things that WMATA is doing. So I want to drill down a little bit, and that starts on slide 10. Your onboard safety and security systems, we were talking about a barrier. So a review of industry practices revealed to us that a barrier separation between the bus operator and the public is an emerging best practice. In fact, FTA commissioned a study on the barrier separation, and part of that report that came out of it indicates that clearly barrier separations are one of the top things that can be done to prevent operator assaults. So WMATA's current practice is to assign those buses with shields and monitors to the routes with the highest volume of operator assaults. The peer review panel has recommended that this practice continue while the remainder of the fleet is outfitted with shields and monitors, which you heard is ongoing, and WMATA is anticipated to complete that by 2019. So the panel's review of industry literature revealed that not only are the existing shields being implemented, but the industry is now looking at shields which fully enclose the operator compartment. So those are being developed. To our knowledge, they're not used widely in the United States, if at all, but this is something that WMATA and others in the industry should be evaluating. So onto training. This is an area that the panel believes WMATA has done excellent work in. We have not seen evidence of a more robust training program to mitigate operator assaults. Your de-escalation technique training and the training module recently developed by the Metro Transit Police are both top in class. Your role-playing and conflict resolution scenarios are well thought out. And from the peer review panel's perspective, the key will be to ensure delivery of those high-quality training programs to everyone who needs it, which I believe went to a question of one of the board members earlier. Public education, on slide 13. A review of industry reports suggests that public awareness campaigns and community outreach can make bus operator assaults less likely. WMATA is on top of this with several initiatives underway. You've seen those initiatives and heard about those today. The humanization of operators, as well as the Respect Your Ride initiative. So enforcement. The peer review panel's review of industry reports suggests that the following are effective tools to reduce bus operator assaults: the posting of laws and the passenger code of conduct, the presence of police officers on transit vehicles, a service suspension policy. Also, jurisdictions are increasingly adopting enhanced penalties for assaulting a bus operator to deter such assaults. Finally, the deployment of police offers a deterrence and enforce component that helps prevent and mitigate operator assaults, as indicated above. So during our interview process, we learned just how much your operators appreciate the hardworking men and women of the Metro Police Department. They appreciate it so much that they'd like to have a police officer on every bus. We recognize that this is likely not feasible, as all agencies have financial constraints. But the panel does recommend that WMATA conduct a resource allocation analysis to determine if additional police resources are advisable and necessary. The panel also urges WMATA to adopt a mechanism to suspend ridership privileges for persons who commit assaults against bus operators and station managers. This is a tangible action that can mitigate risk immediately. It also has a deterrent effect, and operators will know that they're supported. The panel urges WMATA to pursue legislatively enhanced penalties for assaults on bus operators and station managers. So, for example, in some jurisdictions, a simple assault that's conducted on that takes place on an operator or a police officer and others, say safety-sensitive positions, those are automatically deemed to be aggravated assaults. The panel encourages that the Transit Police Department explore the feasibility of utilizing expectorant collection for DNA processing and subsequent criminal prosecution. These are colloquially known as spit kits. The MTA implemented this in 2014. Being spat upon as an operator, some operators will tell you that I actually read it in the MTA article, an operator saying, I'd rather be punched in the face five times than spat upon. So the spit kits are one step in addressing that problem. Support of assaulted workers, slide 16. I'd just like to highlight one recommendation in this area. The panel is encouraging that WMATA pilot a process where a company representative accompany a bus operator who's been assaulted to court proceedings. So often when you go to a court proceeding as an operator, you run into your assailant. And so having a company representative there is very helpful. Also, if you are successful in getting enhanced penalties, that company representative may be able to encourage the prosecutor to apply the enhanced penalties. On to data. The peer review panel recommends that the Metro Transit Police Department explore the reconciliation of crime data after cases are closed to reflect the actual number of operator assaults. So we learned that following a police investigation, at least some of the incidents that are reported as operator assaults turn out not to have been operator assaults. So I'm not suggesting that the MTPD is doing anything wrong. They're following their standards of reporting that they're required to by law. However, after review of the cases, if it turns out that an assault isn't an assault and they're able to adjust the numbers appropriately and pursuant to law, it will prevent your operator assault numbers from appearing to be overstated. So other observations, slide 18. So we heard from all stakeholders interviewed that many fare conflicts arise from the DC-1 card program. So problems identified were that students often don't possess their cards, that the cards don't work, they're not registered, they're loaded not loaded with fare value, or they attempt, non-students possess and attempt to use the cards. So in order to reduce conflicts, the panel recommends that WMATA and the DC government explore other options for providing students with fare media. As you know, fare disputes cause conflict. So if this can be eliminated, that would go a ways towards helping things. Sure. Absolutely. So which part? So in general, the DC One card program, you have students who often don't possess the card. The card doesn't work. Perhaps the card's not registered or loaded with fare value. And sometimes non-students possess and attempt to use the cards. So in order to reduce conflicts over the fare, the panel recommends that WMATA and the District of Columbia explore other options for providing students with fare media so they may safely and efficiently use Metrobus and Metrorail to their schools. None of the people on the panel were experts in this particular program. What caused us to make this recommendation is, again, fare disputes are such a high cause of operator assaults that if this program can be made to run more efficiently, we think it will reduce that problem. So in conclusion, after spending a week with your agents, my colleagues and I concluded that WMATA has already implemented or is in the process of implementing many, if not most, of the industry's best practices for preventing and mitigating assaults on transit operators. You heard that today in Joe Leader's presentation. It was our impression that clearly WMATA takes very seriously the safety of its transit workers. On behalf of the peer review team, I want to thank the board, General Manager Paul Wiedefeld, Joe Leader, Pat Lavin, and your staff for their full cooperation during our review. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rotter. And we want to thank you and your team for doing such a nice job of doing this peer review and certainly the support of APTA in putting this all together, Ms. Hansen. I have a couple of questions. First of all, one thing you mentioned is as a recommendation, was to suspend service to certain customers that create problems on the system. How is that accomplished from a practical viewpoint?
So I'm not as familiar with it as my colleague from Seattle was, the chief of police there. Seattle Metro has adopted a suspension of service program. So essentially what you need to do is, I don't want to address the legal side of things and how you have to do it, but you have to provide some form of due process. So you'd spell out the rules, you'd spell out what can and can't, what constitutes cause for suspension. You have to have an appeal process, and then I believe what we've done in certain circumstances is we have the police will send out a bolo to the garages, notifying folks this particular individual has been suspended and can't ride.
But that probably requires a lot of enforcement from the police agents to make sure that happens. Is that correct?
Again, I don't have personal experience with the enforcement, but it does require it's certainly going to require some vigilance. But it provides another tool for the operator, because in many instances, what you'll find is that a particular operator runs into the same customers over and over, and a particular customer becomes a problem customer, and then there's a dispute and there's an assault, and so it's oftentimes the operators will know who those folks are, and it gives them a technique to be able to call the control center and say, this person who's been suspended has boarded my bus.
Thank you. Now, when you talk about fair disputes, are you talking about fair evasion primarily?
It can be anything from fair evasion to primarily fair evasion. It can be fair evasion, but it could also be, you know, an operator. You know, look, operators want to collect the correct fare. It's sort of a lot of them view it as their job. So if someone, even if they pay the wrong fare, or it's not necessarily that they're not paying at all, maybe they want to go a certain number of zones. I'm not sure if you have zones here, but I have zones up in transit. So someone will present a one-zone ticket and travel three zones. That can create conflict.
And there's lots of recommendations out of this report. Can I ask Mr. Leader, Mr. Lavin, how you guys are reacting to these recommendations? Are you putting them in place, tracking them, what?
We met briefly yesterday with Ann Hill-Pena, who runs Quico. They track out caps. We're going to treat these as corrective actions, so we're going to document when we receive them, how we respond them, and track them to closure, as we would with any other cap.
Thank you. I want to go to Ms. Harley to see if she has any questions. Ms. Harley?
Yes, thank you so much, Chair Lobby. The question that I have is in regards to this review. I noted that a lot of your recommendations and observations show WMATA instituting a lot of the best practices that you have noted. Would you say that this is surprisingly preemptive on WMATA's part? It's in line with what other agencies are doing. Where would you rate a lot of these practices that we've been discussing in regards to tracking WMATA's progress in implementing a lot of the points that you observed and raised?
So when we conducted this review in mid-November, that's the time point. And for our peer review committee, we weren't looking, you know, backwards in time. All we knew is what was occurring at that point in time. And at that point in time, in mid-November, as I think we've identified, WMATA was, in most respects, I would say, ahead of the curve. The report does identify some areas and in our recommendations that where we think improvements can be made.
Anything else, Ms. Harley?
I believe that was it. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from committee members? Mr. Dorsey, do you have anything for us? Okay. Other members of the board? Yes, Mr. Goldman.
I just want to take advantage of Mr. Rotter's expertise while he's here and tell us about experience at New Jersey Transit. Do you or did you have a bus operator assault problem? What specific steps were taken at New Jersey Transit in response, and what worked and what didn't work?
Right. So, you know, so every bus operator assault is a problem when it is indeed an assault. And so we have, working with the union over the past several years, actually, undertaken an ongoing sort of process where we meet as a committee and discuss, you know, the issues and work through them. And so that has led to some improvements. I believe that's led to some changes. It's led to us implementing a barrier system as well. We're working on, we have in New Jersey, we were able to, working, you know, together in partnership with the union, actually encourage the legislature to pass an enhanced penalty for bus operator assaults. And we are working to try to make sure that those enhanced penalties are enforced.
So what I've heard is you've added bus shields and enhanced penalties for bus operator assaults from the legislature.
Yep.
And both of those have been effective in reducing bus operator assaults?
We believe so. The operators believe so. And it's an ongoing process. I mean, it's not like you put you do one solution and the problem goes away. I'd say it's, you know, we're doing other things. We're continually working with folks. We're trying to also allocate resources to be able to attend hearings. issues with assaulted operators. I've attended a hearing with an assaulted operator and helped to make sure that the enhanced penalty was enforced. So, you know, there's a number of steps we're taking. We're still looking at things.
By hearings, you're talking about court proceedings.
Yes. Yes, we've just implemented cameras inside the buses, much as you've done. So a lot of the same things you're hearing in this report are things we've either done or we're looking at doing.
Thank you.
Okay, so hello. Well, so are we okay with our bus shield compared to other properties around the country and the world?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just quickly to say that those of us who have been elected leaders in charge of jurisdictions, that the issue of conflicts between public employees and the public is not unknown in those things, too. And I just wanted to say that I think that the conflict resolution training is really important in what you're doing. The barriers, the other things are good, but they're not going to take you all the way. You really need that conflict resolution training, which is not to blame the operators, but just to say it's a really important tool for anybody who's dealing with the public in this kind of a situation, particularly as the bus operators do when they're often put in the middle of a conflict that they didn't really have anything to do with. So I'm glad that you're doing that, and I would really encourage you. There's good conflict resolution training and bad conflict resolution training. Some of it's more effective than others. And I would really encourage you to put an emphasis on it and get some good training for the operators, given that skill.
Thank you, Mr. Lawley. My question is actually more for APTA. In your framing, if you're putting together the panel, you're trying to get different stakeholders. Where's the operator? Bus driver, help me understand why that's not a part of this.
Well, in some respects it was. Miami, you had the head of bus operations who would
no,
come.
No, not a head. I mean, someone who is actually, an operator who could look and say, you know what I'm saying, instead of a higher level.
And we interviewed operators, and the union as well joined us as part of the conversation.
I understand that side of it. What I'm saying is when you're structuring the panel itself, getting someone who from another property is a union representative, is an operator. I mean, is that? I'm just trying to understand like why that wouldn't have been a part of this, because they would have had a very different perspective, I think, in the way that they would have looked at this versus folks who are
managers. I hear you, sir. Mm-hmm.
I would point out, though, that the individual from Miami was actually a bus operator who then rose to the ranks, so they did have some degree of that experience, but I understand your point.
Okay, I would just suggest that, I think that would have...
Going forward, having union representation or somebody from labor.
It would have enhanced kind of, when you're trying to get a review, you want different perspectives.
Yes, sir.
I just would have appreciated having that perspective in that, too.
So noted.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I want to thank staff for the good presentations today, excellent presentations, and I want to thank Ms. Hansen and Mr. Rotter for being here today and presenting to us. Thank you very much. This meeting stands adjourned.